Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, January 21st. And while automation has long been known to cut labor costs in the United States and displace some workers, new research underscores its pivotal role in widening disparities right now. In the past 40 years, at least half, if not more, of the increasing wage gap among American workers is attributable to automation, according to MIT economist Darren Acemoglu. His research shows this is particularly true for men without college degrees. But if you think of this as just having to do with machines that replace factory workers, it's becoming much more in the 21st century. You know, the last few years have brought rapid advancements in not just hardware, but software and artificial intelligence that have the potential to displace even more workers and more kinds of workers. So we're going to talk about this now. Joining me now for a Tech News Roundup is Steve Lohr, who has covered technology, business, and economics for the New York Times for more than 20 years. Maybe you saw his article, Economists Pin More Blame on Tech for Rising Inequality. Steve, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Appreciate it.
Steve, as you write in your piece, automation wasn't always seen as a bad thing from a labor standpoint. You write, economists point to the post-war years from 1950 to 1980 as a golden age when technology forged ahead and workers enjoyed rising incomes. So how did they coexist?
You get shared prosperity when the technology moves ahead, as does training and education. And that was the story from really the early 1950s to the 1980s. And after that, the growth in post-secondary education started to decline in the United States. Employers spent less on training, and we had started to see this divergence, which has only increased.
When and why did the wheels start to fall off the wagon?
The technology that came in and was on the factory floor, it was computerized machinery and robots, and in offices, it's specialized software. And those things were the automation technologies, and the level of skills that people had couldn't keep up with to stay ahead of the new technology, and many of these jobs were automated. On the office side, I always kind of think of the movie Working Girl from the late 80s, which is Melanie Griffith and Harrison Ford, and she works in the secretarial pool in the center and eventually makes her way out to a management job. And those pools that existed in the 80s don't exist anymore. I mean, we have 750,000 fewer secretaries in America than we once did, because those jobs, we all do the input ourselves now. And we had a policy regime, really, that over time has greatly worked to the advantage of the machines and the software and less to the advantage of workers. And a simple example is the taxation. I mean, the cost for a company to invest in a worker with including income taxes and payroll taxes is about 25%. Because of a series of tax cuts over time, the cost to invest in machinery, the tax rate on investing in machinery and software is close to zero. So the incentives are push you also in the direction of automation.
And you write, citing one economist in your article, that we may be headed for what he calls the Turing trap, which is a reference to mathematician and artificial intelligence pioneer Alan Turing. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, the Turing test has been around for a long time. It's essentially you create a dialogue system so that is good enough in its responses to your questions that a human being can't tell whether the answers and the conversation coming from the other side is a human being or a machine. And if you can't tell the difference, you've passed the Turing test. And that's a metaphor for, what technology should do is equal human performance, and therefore sort of replace it. And the people who say we should take a different direction in technology development say what we really should be doing is looking at technologies that enhance human performance rather than replace people. And I mean, the sort of simplest example is of a good technology is a personal computer, which Steve Jobs always described as a bicycle for the mind. You know, it makes you better. It augments you. It doesn't replace you.
I guess that wouldn't apply to one of the examples that somebody just wrote in on Twitter. Says, did you see that minor league baseball teams are planning to test robot umpires?
Yeah.
How are you going to argue with a cell phone?
Well, you know, they're doing this a little bit in tennis too now, right? On the ball, you know, for line judges and things. No fun.
You know, and not to overemphasize an example from pro sports, but it raises the dilemma, I think, in a clear way. So if a machine with lenses can call balls and strikes more accurately than a human being, and I think that's mostly how it would be deployed, to call the strike zone more consistently and more accurately than human umpires do, that could apply to a lot of other kinds of jobs. And then the question is really pertinent. What if the machines can just do the job better? What's our responsibility as human beings to have the best job done versus keeping other human beings employed?
From an economic standpoint, you want the human beings to be productively employed, not just give them a job that they do less well than the machine. The hope and the way it has been, you know, for ever since the industrial era began, was that the machines took over some jobs, but others were created. That humans could do better working with the machines than a machine could do alone. And that's still an open question as to whether that's what we're going to see happen.
Stephanie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with New York Times business and technology writer Steve Lohr. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello, Brian. One of the reasons that the auto workers did so well in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, even though jobs are being automated, was because the unions, UAW and other unions, helped make sure that they would get the training and make sure that they got like a decent percent of the profits and so forth. But now, so the question is, what, now that, so few places are unionized and that kind of thing, I can picture like a dystopian world where, you know, there's a handful of billionaires that own all the machinery and that we all are just this like underclass of unemployed unemployed people that are being so how do we do we need universal basic income, or is there some other way to make sure that he who owns the machines does not rule the entire world, and that, you know, the rest of us, if we can't get it, if we have a job, that make sure we get a decent portion of the profits? That's
Stephanie, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that was the Andrew Yang presidential campaign, right? Automation is taking so many jobs and potential future jobs from human beings that we need universal basic income provided by the government. Right, Steve?
I would suggest that the Yang position is both way too optimistic about technology and what it can do in the near term and sort of too pessimistic about, you know, where humans fit in. To address your listener's question, I mean, one of the quotes from the MIT economist looking at the technology in this rising wage inequality is that, yes, but it's not an act of God. You know, technology is a tool, and we as a society, in terms of corporate behavior, policy, and we as a society decide to use it. And when people look at what's going to happen in the future, I mean, the pace and growth of artificial intelligence is sort of the X factor. But the people in the economists in particular in this article that I wrote were lobbying for a change in that atmosphere. And some of that atmosphere is exactly, again, as your caller and your listener said, you know, one of the things that's made it easier to automate has been the decline of the power of workers broadly, both unions and beyond, and some of these tax changes I mentioned before. And I mean, those are things that, you know, public opinion can change. And we've changed the direction of technology in the past. Again, the Duron Acemoglu, the MIT economist, uses what's happened with renewable resources as an inspiration. I mean, this is something that, because of incentives, policy, government research, social pressure on corporations to not pollute and contribute to carbon emissions, has steered, you know, the development of technology in this in a different direction. And his argument and some others are that we ought to be able to do a similar thing with the direction of technology and automation and making sure humans are always in the loop and have a say.
Here's another example from another caller in another industry, I think. Sarah in Bay Ridge. You're on WNYC. Hi. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brian. I work in the fashion industry, and I agree with what everybody's saying, but it's about the creativity, I think. And that's what's missing in the automated world when everyone's talking about technology. And I work for a company, I work for multiple companies, I won't name them, but in a photo studio, we used to have photographers and models and hairdressers and makeup artists and, of course, stylists and digitechs and assistants. And now the set is just a stylist and that's it, because we shoot on a green screen and with a green model. It's called Looklet. And it's a great process, but all I have to do is push a button and the model moves and you turn her around and I get to scan a barcode and choose the shoes, choose the, you know, the blouse, and then it's cropped and it's nose and below. And so all these major high e-commerce companies are just shooting, the basic catalog looks. And so the creativity and the skill set that I've learned for the past 20 years on set has gone down and dwindled down through this automation. And though we can shoot, you know, 80 clothes or 80 pieces of clothing, it really diminishes all the work that I went into school for.
Sarah, what a compelling example. Thank you so much for your call. And Steve, we're getting, you know, all kinds on the phones that we're not going to have time for. Somebody who works in a restaurant says he's getting reservations now from Google Assistant calling him up rather than human beings in some cases. We have a retired school teacher calling in who would say over the years it changed from technology assisting teachers to teachers assisting technology. We have a musician calling in to talk about, you know, all the live instrumentalist jobs that are being replaced by all the sounds that can be generated. We have somebody calling in to say the whole thing is an economic catch-22 because machines can replace workers, but they're not going to buy products. So they don't create more jobs in that respect. So let's sum it up like this, or not sum it up, but ask what there is to do about this, because you write in your article, the concerns raised by economists are getting more attention in Washington at a time when the tech giant companies are already being attacked on several fronts. So what sorts of proposals are lawmakers putting forward as a way to slow down job displacement from artificial intelligence or other automation?
Yeah, and there's actually just started last year. There's a House Select Committee on Economic Disparity and Fairness and Growth. A guy named Jim Himes, who's a Connecticut Democrat, chairs it. And there's bipartisan kind of agreement on putting more federal money kind of intelligently into skills and training and upgrading skills programs to help people who have fallen behind to get jobs that enable them to move into the middle class. And a lot of this is some functional skills with using digital technology. That's certainly turning around this cycle of less training and less secondary education that's geared to this, along with technological progress to equip people more for this new world, is one thing that you do get you know, bipartisan actually consensus on in Washington. And that's, they're going to come forward with things. I mean, part of this is as consumers. I mean, if we only purchase what's standard and cheap, right, that lends itself to the routine work that that robots and automated software can do. If, as your caller mentioned, I mean, there, you know, the innovation and the diversity of the fashion industry is something that is valued. You know, we should get more of that. So it's, you know, there's a public policy side to this. There's who you vote for. There's strengthening workers, and there's, you know, your behavior as a shopper.
We're just about out of time. I'm going to ask you one question on another thing because I can't resist.
Sure.
Mayor Eric Adams here in New York is reportedly going to convert his first paycheck today to cryptocurrency, some in Bitcoin, some in another one called Ethereum.
Yeah, right.
Not as many people as have heard of, but as I think the number two most valuable, according to reports I've seen.
Right.
And I guess I have two quick questions about this. One is, do you think, as Adams predicts, because I think this is why he's doing it, that there's a big industry in cryptocurrency that will actually produce jobs in New York City if companies choose to locate them here? And number two, do you see any kind of societal risk from the proliferation of crypto there, or people you've, you know, talked to as a tech reporter? There's an article in These Times this week about how crypto has to be a bubble. The bubble is going to burst, and it's going to cause all kinds of social disruption.
Yeah, to answer your first question, Brian, yes. I mean, this is the way mayors around the country see this as, you know, as a growth industry, and are really trying to track them. Miami's got a huge effort to get people to move there who are in the crypto world. Also, our, you know, Goldman Sachs and others, I mean, the New York financial industry business are developing, you know, crypto units and so forth. So from an economic development standpoint, yes. And from a concern standpoint and a bubble concern, I mean, the wrong word here is currency that people, you know, Bitcoin is a speculative asset, like a hot stock. It's not, you know, a medium of payment and a storehouse of value, which is how we think of as a currency, of currencies as. And so kind of mistaking it for that, I think is a real mistake. And it's not, unlike your bank deposits, there's no federal deposit insurance. I mean, it's a pretty wild west out there.
So some people do accept payment for things in crypto. Now,
I got to build this other way, you know, either direct transfer from the bank or we do cryptocurrency. This is from our local accountant. I have reservations to put it mildly about this, but I, you know, that's, these things move forward and it's going to be regulated. If it gets big enough, it has to be.
And we'll do more in crypto from various points of view on the show over time. We have to leave it there for today with Steve Lohr, New York Times technology and economics reporter. His latest in the Times is called "Economists Pin More Blame on Tech for Rising Inequality." Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.